I think of torches, I want to think of the Statue of Liberty, and when I think of candlelight, I want to think of prayer vigils. And this was a parade of hatred and bigotry and racism and intolerance.
You pretend you're patriots. You are not patriots. You are dividers.
The event has been declared an unlawful assembly.
They want to destroy everything you care about. We're not going anywhere.
The counter-protesters at the high rate of speed knocking down the victims in its path. This is the woman who was so tragically killed. She was 32 years old.
I don't see a difference in her and, you know, someone who, you know, died in Iraq or somebody who died on 9/11. It was still a terrorist attack.
James Alex Fields, Jr., a road-raging terrorist.
I didn't know it was white supremacists. I thought it had something to do with Trump.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're glad to have you with us today. White supremacy, white nationalism, violence, and death in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. The nation watched as uniformed, slogan-shouting white nationalist groups rallied in Emancipation Park near the university founded by Thomas Jefferson, and as armed militias in flak jackets carrying long guns stood by like paramilitaries.
One guy, he talked about how Africa for the black man, America for the white man, and that was sort of what they were aiming for. So a really, frankly, sort of warped play on a Marcus Garvey idea from the 19-teens and 1920s.
That's an eyewitness to the demonstrations in Charlottesville over the weekend who we'll talk to in just a moment. Counter-protests on Saturday turned violent, and then one man who was seen earlier lined up with white nationalist demonstrators and holding a shield allegedly sped his car into a crowd of people, injuring at least 19 people and killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer. James Alex Fields, an Ohio man described as a Nazi sympathizer, is in police custody and charged with second-degree murder. Throughout this hour, we'll talk to people in and around Charlottesville reacting to the weekend and what it means as America thinks through another display of Confederate history, of racism and violence, and we'll hear voices from around the nation, including yours.
This is Cherie from Oakland, California. As a nation, everyone should be outraged, but of course, this is just more of the same disregard from the establishment.
My name is Iris. I'm from Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey. We should respond with one voice that this kind of behavior will not be tolerated in the United States, and it needs to start with the president.
Your voice all this hour as we take stock of a violent weekend in Virginia. Aaron Frazier is a graduate of the University of Virginia in politics and African American studies. She's also a 2017 Rhodes Scholar, and she was an eyewitness at the protests on Friday and Saturday in Charlottesville.
They would throw water bottles, and it was unclear what the water bottles were filled with until, you know, they hit the ground. Sometimes that was chemical gas. Sometimes it was pepper spray. Some people were hit by urine that was filling the water bottles as well.
What do you think the nation is missing in how we're viewing these protests, the counter demonstrations? What are we missing about the nature of white supremacy or the nature of these protests and what they mean?
Well, it's a few things. So one, for all of the talk about, you know, the alt-right demonstrators coming to Charlottesville with the intention of exercising their right to free speech and their right to assembly, they certainly came prepared to inflict real harm. And that's clear by the gear that they brought, right? They brought bottles filled with chemicals to throw at protesters. They came with helmets. They came with shields. You don't really see a whole lot of that on the counter-protesters side. Myself, I was raising a poster board that I had that had a Martin Luther King Jr. quote on it as cover over my head. So I think that's one thing that may be being overlooked. I think another thing that's overlooked is really on the side of the counter-protesters, there was so much camaraderie and so much community that was being built in that space. And so if people had extra earbuds or extra gloves or extra face masks, they were offering that up to the people who they were surrounded by, people who they'd never met before. You had people out on the streets handing out orange slices and cold bottles of water throughout the day. And it was really this level of community and the fact that we were in this together. And I think that is, it's that spirit that I believe will be able to continue to fuel not just counter-protests, but the everyday work of changing policies and practices that reinforce and recreate white supremacy.
There seems to be a debate about whether or not the violence that followed the demonstrations on Saturday was terrorism. There's been a tacit reluctance to call it terrorism, including from the White House. Does this language choice matter to you as somebody who was involved, as somebody who was there, whether the car crash and the death and the injuries that everyone saw is called domestic terrorism?
Oh, it absolutely matters. And the fact that people, leaders, are reluctant to, you know, call a spade and call a terrorist is shameful. If a Muslim American had ran a car into a crowd of people who were just walking down the street, it would have instantly been labeled a terrorist attack. And so the question becomes, can only non-white people be terrorists? Is it only people of color? Because this is homegrown terror. This is terror that's being reinforced in people's homes, that's not being, you know, challenged, or at least not challenged strongly enough within our schools, that is raising up this new generation, right? The people who were out in those streets were young. They were young people who were talking about Africa for the black man, America for the white man, and talking about the differences in the brain sizes between the races. So this is certainly something that is homegrown, and it wasn't grown back in the 20s or the 30s or the 40s or the 50s. It was grown, you know, in the 90s. It's being grown and passed on to their children today. And we have to do something to address that and stop it. And it has to start with calling it what it is.
Before I let you go, you mentioned that you protected yourself in the melee there with a poster with some quotes from Dr. Martin Luther King. What did your poster say?
The quote on it is, "We must accept finite disappointment, but never lose infinite hope."
What's the finite disappointment that you were talking about when you wrote that on the placard?
The violence and the utter inhumanity that was on display by the driver of that car, by people pelting rocks and throwing pepper spray into the streets. I think it's clear that that's disappointing. But the hope is always for tomorrow and always for what we can change in the future and what we can change for our children and our children's children. But that takes a profound sense of being able to stay the course and persevere through that finite disappointment.
Aaron Frazier, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Aaron Frazier is a graduate of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville and a 2017 Rhodes Scholar. One of the immediate issues that brought white nationalists to Charlottesville, Virginia, is the planned removal of the town statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Now, there are thousands of Confederate monuments all across the South, from statues to street names, and several cities have made moves recently to remove or at least relocate their monuments. On Saturday, after the violence in Charlottesville, the mayor of Lexington, Kentucky, said he's accelerating plans to relocate two Confederate monuments in his city if he can get the city council to go along. Mayor Jim Gray is here. Mayor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, Todd. Glad to be with you this morning. And your conversation just now with Aaron was moving and inspiring. Her comments were surely on point.
Right. So you listened to that conversation there. And now, absolutely, after the events in Charlottesville, Mayor, you've said that you're going to accelerate your plans to remove these couple of monuments from your city. Charlottesville didn't cause this. This has been an ongoing debate in your city. So why is it critical now?
Well, I'd planned on Tuesday of this week to announce my recommendation to the city council that we remove and relocate the two Confederate monuments. They are located today on really what amounts to sacred ground. They're located on an area called Cheapside, where slave auctions were held before the Civil War. It's one of the largest slave auction sites in America in the South. And these two Confederate monuments are there, and they're inappropriately today honoring Confederate men who fought to preserve slavery. And it's on the very ground that men and women and often children were sold into slavery. And that's just not right.
Mayor, I understand that a review board in your city had recommended this removal as far back as 2015. Why has it taken so long to get to this point? And do you think that it's the events in Charlottesville that are the final catalyst to get this removal going in Lexington?
Yeah, we listened to our citizens. There, as you can imagine, as we hear this today, there are many points of view on this issue. And we listened and we heard our citizens. We put together a plan. There's a long process here that we have to go through, and that includes our city council resolution and then a petition to what's called the Kentucky Military Heritage Commission, who has authority for these monuments to move them. Our plan is to petition, with the council's approval, to petition the Heritage Commission and ask for the authority then to move them.
Mayor, these are statues. They're symbols. They're important, but they're not the real important part of this debate and your actions here. What do you want the message to be to people in Kentucky and around the nation to moving these Confederate monuments out of a major city in the South and to another location?
There's no perfect time to speak out against hatred and violence. There's no perfect time. Standing up and speaking out is a responsibility of us, especially as elected officials, and not sitting back and relaxing in times like this. Now, these are American values that we're talking about, liberty and justice and freedom. It's so much about dealing with our history in a truthful way. And that's what this debate symbolizes in my view today. And you heard it from Aaron so well and so eloquently just now.
And I assume we're going to let you go, Mayor, but you expect to get significant pushback, yes?
Well, there's always pushback. What I've learned is that mayors in these decisions, we're on the razor's edge. We're on the front lines. But we're given these opportunities. They're, in many respects, they may be blessings because we're giving these opportunities to really stand up for what America has believed in.
Jim Gray is the mayor of Lexington, Kentucky. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
My name is Joe. I'm from Red Bluff, California. My father is the 94-year-old veteran of the D-Day invasion. He's still alive. He's in the home. He's probably not able to understand this news. He has Alzheimer's, but I know how he would feel about a Nazi uprising on American soil because he lost his buddies. He lost his buddies fighting the Nazis. We will not stand for this. We will not stand for a president who cannot unequivocally denounce it.
Your voice all this hour at 877-8MYTAKE.